Okay, so our final presentation today. Am I okay, Terry, with microphones? Can you hear me okay? I've got some flyers for this talk as well, so maybe while we sort out the PA, there's some leaflets that I don't want to take in my suitcase back with me. So.
If you just hooked everything up. Yep, this is the speaker and this is the recorder.
Great, okay. Right, great. So I should apologize for talking about cooking and the last session on the last day just before lunch, but I'm going to talk on this title, Cookery Lessons and Engineers' Observations on the Role of Participation in the Uptake of Improved Cook Stoves in Sub-Saharan Africa. And I should say that this is really an engineer and four social scientists observations, and I should thank my co-authors Kemi, Temi, Charlotte and Sarah, who are absolutely a joy and delight to work with. They're social scientists, and it's been great as an engineer to work with them over many years. I thought it'd be good to wake you up and to start you off with a question and to ask you, what's the difference between an engineer and a social scientist? And maybe, does anyone want to chip in on that? Yep, about 30,000 a year, that's a good answer.
Conscience.
Conscience? Okay. Do you have this one, what do you say to arts graduate after graduation? 6 months after graduation, do you hear this one? What do you say to an arts graduate student 6 months after graduation? Big Mac and fries, please. But anyway, my sort of take on this is that I think engineers are optimists. And when we look at a problem, something deep within an engineer stirs, and like a space rocket launch sequence, we initiate a methodological approach of defining a design brief, developing a solution, and we iterate our solutions until we come up with a final product or service, and then we launch it on the relevant market. Whereas social scientists, on the other hand, tend to be more pessimistic, and they observe rather than engage directly with the messy world is what they do best. Take cooking stoves, for example. The pictures here, when an engineer sees these pictures, sees someone's cooking on an open fire, he notices the inefficient use of biomass, the lack of suitable ventilation, the disregard for health and safety, and reaching for some paper or a computer screen, we certainly start to sketch out a brand new stove, complete with chimney, temperature control, ash collection, and 100 other essential extras that no one ever asked for. We optimize our designs, and thousands or millions of improved cook stoves are produced and scattered liberally amongst the bemused cooks. And the result of parachuting in such technological innovations rarely live up to the expectations of the designers and the hype of the marketing team. And on the cook stove front, as we'll see, many improved cook stoves have been launched in sub-Saharan Africa with mixed results. The social scientist, rather than looking at the cook stove, looks at the person doing the cooking. Here we go. I have my cook's hat here. Why is the person cooking in this way? What are the cultural factors involved? Is gender an issue? And so on. Both these stereotypes have some merits and problems. The engineer's boundless optimism cannot cope with problems that have no solution. When things don't go to plan, prototypes are discarded, and we try a new approach. Think of it as a challenge rather than a failure. Whereas the social scientist will probably sit back and say, I told you so. There are problems that you just can't fix. So looking at a specific example, interesting, moving on from talking about fracking in South Africa, this is a situation in the Niger Delta in Nigeria. And we're looking at the problem of cooking there. Most people in the region cook on open biomass fires or wood fires, while gas is flared off from the oil fields, wasting energy and causing pollution. This is what really happens when oil companies move into Africa. They don't use best practice. They use what they can get away with often. Enter the engineers, the good people from Project Gaia, an American-led organization with Swedish partners who have developed a camping stove that runs on liquid fuel. The organization's website says that they will work with the oil companies to develop methanol fuel, which could be provided to the local people. Doesn't say whether they're going to charge them for it or not. And it sounds like a great solution, solving the problems of deforestation, pollution, and fuel poverty at a single stroke. But life's often not that simple. When Project Gaia arrived on the ground in Nigeria and talked to the local people, they were told if they had anything to do with the oil companies, then the local people will have nothing to do with your stoves, because the oil companies pollute our rivers, they use up our land, and we don't see any of the benefits from them being here. So they change tack, and they look at some stats, and they realize that 80% of cassava in Nigeria rots in the fields. There's a glut. So the proposal is to turn this excess cassava into biofuel, bioethanol. But there's a problem. 80% of cassava rots in the fields, not because people don't want to eat it, but because the infrastructure is so bad, you can't get it to market. You can't get it to the people that want to eat it. So if you go in and start buying up cassava and paying a premium, you put the price up, and people will have a nice shiny stove, but they won't be able to afford any food to cook on it. So they change tack again. Okay, what we'll do is we'll bring in a GM modified version of cassava that's got a high sugar yield that you can't eat. So there won't be a food versus fuel problem then, will there? Yeah, but where are you going to grow this cassava? The farmers that are growing cassava that you eat at the moment are going to turn over their land to produce biofuels, and again, you're going to have this problem. And the problems continue. For each technological solution, a new social problem is created. And the resulting stove and fuel, in the end, are only affordable by the emerging middle class, not the people on $1 a day that the website claims that they're setting out to help. I came across this quote by Margaret Mead. Has anyone heard of Margaret Mead? Great, okay. She seems to be a really interesting character, and I'd love to read more about her. Anthropologist, and she had some involvement in putting together the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, I think, in the 1970s. She says, no society has ever been able to handle the temptations of technology to mastery, to waste, to exuberance, to exploration and exploitation. We have to learn to cherish this earth and cherish it as something that's fragile. We have to use our scientific knowledge to correct the dangers that have come from science and technology. I've seen the Clean Cook Stove on my travels in Ethiopia. And in the Ethiopian government is in the news at the moment with plans to build a new dam to generate hydropower and also to enable to clear some land to enable to grow more sugarcane to produce bioethanol. According to an Ethiopian scientist, if this dam is completed across the Omo River, the result will be a cascade of hydrological, ecological, and social economic impacts that will generate a region-wide crisis for the indigenous livelihoods and biodiversity in the region. Indigenous peoples rely on the natural flood cycles of the river for farming, fishing, and livestock grazing. The chief of the Karo people says, when we talk about the Omo River, we are talking about our life. The Omo River is everything to us, but we don't have a say. So if biofuels have their problems, what about solar cookers? I know there's a solar enthusiast here. I don't know whether he's in the audience today. I had a good big chat. Hi. We had a chat yesterday. Solar cookers use the sun's rays to generate heat to cook food without the need for any other fuel. And here's some photos from an exhibition of solar cooking and alternative technologies in Kenya. Temiladi took these photos, and she's absolutely brilliant to work with. Star PhD student, and I'm working with her. She's now a lecturer back in Nigeria. And she's a real smart cookie. And the people were saying, look at the interest in these solar cookers. And she noticed something really odd about this photo, the bottom right situation. Can you see what's really odd about this situation? It's all men. It's the same as all the speakers today. We have an entirely male speaking session today, if you haven't noticed from the program. It's all men. And in Kenya, the men aren't known for doing the cooking, to put it politely. So Temeladi sidles up to these blokes around this dish, this solar cooker dish. And she says, what are you looking at? Why are you interested? And one of the men says, this is a satellite dish. I think we can get Sky TV on this. And solar cookers might have their place, but generally they're large, they're bulky, they're expensive, and they're difficult to use generally. And you can only cook when the sun's shining. So let's take a step back. What's so bad about cooking on wood stoves? Over the last 40 years ago, various reasons have been proposed as why cooking on wood as a fuel is bad. Initially in the 1970s, deforestation was thought to be the issue. And while this might be true for some regions, it's now generally accepted that the main causes of deforestation are the use of wood for industrial applications, construction, and clearing land for large-scale agriculture, such as palm nut oil plantations. Domestic cooking is generally not a major cause of deforestation. In the 1970s, 1980s, the attention switched to indoor air pollution, and I'm going to tackle that in a few slides' time. More recently, attention's been drawn to CO2 and black carbon emissions. Open cook stoves are estimated to contribute about a third of the global carbon dioxide emissions, with black carbon particles and other pollutants in biomass smoke thought to exacerbate climate change. There are also issues of safety around women and children involved in collecting firewood in remote areas, having to travel large distances into the bush where they're particularly vulnerable. But what about the health issue? Here's a sticker on a stove with a very stark message. Smoke in the kitchen is a health hazard, deal with it. And I think this is a very Western top-down approach and ignores the problem of people that are not able to change their stove or cooking practices for financial or cultural reasons. But since we're a bunch of scientists, I'm gonna throw you some data, and if you promise to keep listening for a few minutes, I'll even chuck in a graph in a few slides' time. So here's my table. And this table has the indoor air pollution levels of particulates, PM2.5, measured in a variety of situations for a number of studies around the world. You can look at the report there, the WHO report, if you want further details on these. And we can see that cooking on an open fire produces a staggering 1,000 micrograms per cubic meter of PM2.5. Adding a chimney brings the level down to about 400. If you use a so-called improved stove, you might be at about 300, 380 in this case. Switch to gas, 280. Even if you move to an electric stove, you're at 80 micrograms per meter cubed. Way above the sort of annual air quality guidelines proposed by the World Health Organizations. Where am I? Yes, right. And the reason for this lack of reduction, you might be surprised where an electric stove is still, you have a level of 80 here. Why? What's that going on there? Well, we need to look at the whole situation, the way people are cooking. And the fact is that people like to cook and eat at the same times in many communities, as we've proved by the sort of queues for dinner, breakfast and our evening meals. We all like to eat at the same times. And if you've switched to a clean stove, a gas stove, electric stove, a solar stove, it doesn't make a huge difference to your level of indoor pollution if your neighbour is still burning a wood stove. Or in some situations where you're trying to keep mosquitoes away, so you're burning bits of rubber in the garden, having switched to a cleaner stove, so you're getting pollution from those rubber tyres that you're burning instead. What about the health impacts of a moderate reduction in indoor air pollution brought about by an improved stove? Does halving the level of pollution have a significant effect on health? Well, here's the graph. Well done, you've stayed awake for it. Of the relative risk of developing acute lower respiratory infection against exposure level of PM2.5. And you can see that the graph rapidly increases and then levels off. Here's the WHO air quality guidelines on our graph. You can see they're right down at the bottom here. The relative risk means basically, if you're at this sort of pollution level here, your risk of developing these diseases is 2.5 times as much, and so on. Let's put on our stoves, the data from that table. And you can see that if you switch to the cleanest option, an electric stove, your relative risk only reduces from around 3 to about 2. So it's still, I would say, not good enough. The data here is a lot messier and a lot more uncertain than these smooth lines perhaps suggest. So we've looked at some of the problems in cooking with wood. What about benefits? Are there any? here's three listed. For if our wood is harvested in a sustainable way, it's a sustainable resource. It's a sustainable fuel. It's a resource that people have been using for thousands or tens of thousands of years. In rural areas, if wood is freely available, it's seen as a free resource. But collecting firewood can take up a lot of time, particularly for women and children in the community. And some improved stove programs have highlighted this time saving, but there's only sort of anecdotal evidence to suggest that the time saved in collecting firewood actually goes to good use, for example, in education for women and children. It can be a culturally appropriate fuel to use, and as we said, it's free as well. In the title of my presentation, I mentioned participation, and I want to unpack that with some examples of what I think are participatory approaches to cookstove development. And I'd argue that these fit within a sort of Christian approach to development as well. I'm not using a lot of Bible verses in my presentation today, though. So the first case study I've got here is from Kenya. And here, 80% of urban families use a metal jiko stove, a charcoal burning stove, for cooking. It uses half as much fuel as cooking on an open fire and also decreases cooking times. The cost of the stove can be recovered in fuel savings in just a few months, but that can be problematic if people are living hand to mouth on a dollar a day. They don't have that money to save for a stove, so there has to be sort of microfinance initiatives going alongside the introductions of these stoves. It's estimated that the widespread uptake of the Jiko stove saves about 200,000 tons of wood or 500,000 acres of trees per year. And in rural areas, community-based projects employ local potters to produce the ceramic filters that go into the metal stove cases here. My next example is a project, a PhD project, that I supervised a few years ago. The guy here, dressed as a Thunderbird's puppet, on the bottom right, that's Hugh. Hugh Burnham Slipper, who's a direct descendant of Admiral Nelson, interestingly enough. Hugh was doing some VSO, voluntary service overseas in Eritrea, and he wrote to me and he asked whether he could come and do a PhD to look at making a better cooking stove for Eritrea and Ethiopia. We've seen some pictures of the Magogo stove that they use in these countries. And he did a lot of thermal modeling, some experiments in the lab, and we realized that once he came up with the new design of stove, we really needed some help in testing these stoves and see whether they're any good for actually cooking in Jira. A lot of problems with stove testing, they tend to boil pans of water and not really think about what people are cooking on the stove. So we needed some people that were experienced in cooking in Jira. And Hugh realized that some of our cleaners in the department were from Eritrea. They're asylum seekers and refugees in Nottingham as well from Eritrea. So we asked our cleaners whether they would come in and show us how to cook in Jira. And I think it's the only project in the university that I'm aware of that has used our cleaners as actually participants in the research process. So that's actually in our labs back in Nottingham there. Here's an undergraduate project, Engineers Without Borders UK, a student-run charity that sends undergrads to exciting places to try out some real engineering. And here's Rob Quayle, and he went to Ecuador for a summer. He was there for about 8 weeks. And his task was to go into a village and to help the villagers to switch from open fires to improved stoves. And he had a plan for the stove, and he wanted to source the materials locally, so he had a conversation with the locals about, could you get steel pipes for the chimneys? No, we can't get steel pipes. Okay, we can you get flat metal? Yes, we can get flat metal. Okay, can we bend it around to make some chimneys? And Rob and his friends, I think it was about six of them, spend a couple of weeks in the village making some stoves with the villagers. And then students being students, well, he's in Ecuador, so it'd be rude not to go off and do a bit of trekking, wouldn't it? So he leaves the village for 2 weeks, and him and his friends go off and have a bit of a holiday. And when Rob leaves the village, the men of the village get together and have a conversation, and it goes like this. English schoolboys coming over here to teach us how to build stoves. We can do better than that. And when Rob comes back 2 weeks later, he finds that the villagers have taken the initiative to build five of their own stoves. And you know, they're not optimal, they're not quite Rob's designs. But this stove has been built by Don Matado, and this is Don Matado's stove. And when it breaks, Don Matado will fix it, because he knows how it's built. Rather than someone parachuting in a nice shiny stove and just leaving him to get on with it. I think I've got two more examples. This is another one of my PhD students, Joel Cheney. He's got his doctorate now. And he was involved in looking at turning agricultural waste into fuel briquettes to replace virgin wood and also to use up biomass. And he did a lot of work in Ghana. And then we decided to try and use this idea that he'd used in Ghana in Kenya. And another student society called Students in Free Enterprise, business studies students, they're now called Enactus, wanted to take this idea to the slums of Mombasa in Kenya. And rather than giving them a press and saying, here's the way you do it, go over and make your briquettes, I showed them how to make briquettes by hand. Basically, you mix up your sawdust or we were using banana leaves and things, and you mix it up with a bit of water, squish it with your hands, leave it to dry in the sun for a few days, and then you can use it in place of firewood. And the students went and showed the people how to do this, and they said, well, of course, it'd be good if we had a press. And they said, well, we've got a carpenter in the village. The carpenter can make us a press. So this is the press designed and made in Mombasa by the carpenter. And one of the carpenters involved making the press, he says, hey, could you do with some sawdust? And they say, yeah, we could use some sawdust. So now the carpenter's giving them the sawdust to use in this briquette manufacturing, which is used to support an orphanage over there. This is the project that I've given out some flyers about, that is about 6 months in now. We're looking at cultural barriers, we're looking at financial barriers, we're looking at all sorts of barriers, particularly in southern Africa, trying to understand why people cook the way they cook. East Africa, as I showed you some slides from Kenya, where people are using improved stoves much more widely than southern Africa. We're trying to learn from that East African example and trying to apply some lessons in southern Africa, working with a number of partners, both in South Africa, Zambia, and Malawi, and Nigeria as well. So some conclusions. Hopefully I'm to time, yeah. I think top-down technocentric projects look great. They're very easy to fund. They look great to our engineers as well. They appeal to us, our sort of techno-gadgetry mindset, if you like. But the results may not be long-lived. And I would argue that participatory projects, although they're harder to evaluate, although they might cost more, they have the potential to bring about genuine change from the bottom upwards. And I'll take some questions. Any questions? Or you want your lunch? Yeah.
Are you familiar with the environment?
Yep. Yeah, yeah. There's loads of different ones. They're quite a big outfit. They're starting to make stoves in Africa now, I think. They're doing some assembly, I think, in Kenya of stoves. But they're starting to realize that they really need to be making the stoves in Africa rather than shipping them in. So yeah, they're a good organization. Yeah.
I noticed when I was preparing for my talk, the numbers are all over the place in terms of how many people get.
Yeah.
What numbers do you subscribe to?
So the latest data I heard from the World Health Organization was that indoor air pollution from open stoves is responsible for about 4 million extra deaths a year. And that, interestingly, was equally distributed between men and women, which kind of goes back to this thing that if you're over a certain level of exposure, it doesn't matter how far over you are. Because that was a bit of a surprise, because women and children, or women are doing the cooking, they expected to find that the mortality rates in women were higher than men, but actually it was pretty even across the genders, which kind of goes with this idea that if you want to change the situation, you have to change the village, not just the individual.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think so. So the question was, is it harder to get funding for participatory projects? I think that that's my bias, if you like, because everyone says it's harder to get funding in their discipline. But yeah, and certainly the project that I'm involved in is really pure social science, that we're not building a stove at the end of this. If the outcome is that we need another stove, then that'll be the next project. But it would be a lot easier to pitch in and say, hey, we're going to build a fancy new stove. And some of the projects are really good building new stoves, but I think personally that there are enough new stoves out there, and it's time to really evaluate why people aren't using them. Yeah. I agree with that. I've been so blessed with particularly two Nigerian female PhD students who have been great at going into communities and developing the art of just hanging around and just observing, rather than with a clipboard asking questions, just looking at the way people live. And you learn so much just by listening and looking rather than asking the questions. Yeah. How are we doing? Yeah. So the question is, how do we get in? How do we go through government, or do we go through academics? It varies. Sometimes it's through local universities. So the current project I'm working on, it's great that we've got local university partners. Engineers Without Borders tends to build links with local charities, local NGOs that are already working in the area as well. So there's this idea of continuity and not just it's not the sort of Star Trek approach to projects, which is, you know, once it's done, beam me up, Scotty, and then off and away. So yeah, that long-term relationship is vitally important. Government is a bit difficult, I think. It depends on areas, and you know, it depends with local government as well, and maybe village chiefs or elders as to whether you're going to get permission to do what you want to do, or even what the people would like to do. I know my father's has worked in Eastern Europe on a project, and the local mayor there said, you can do this project now, but that one I want you to do next year, because then I'm up for re-election, and I don't want you to do it before the election campaign starts, so then I can say how wonderful, you know, I am. So there's some real difficult problems, I think, with engaging with the political scene as well. How was it? Yeah, hi.
What is the status of the project, and what is your partner in the relationship?
Yeah, I'm always interested in partnerships. I first started in appropriate technologies by I'm a volunteer with a charity called Tear Fund, which is a UK Christian Relief and Development charity. And I just stuck an advert in one of their newsletters saying, if you've got an engineering problem, drop me a line and I'll see what I can do about it. And the offer's still open, in that I'm quite happy to get requests for ideas or ideas for projects or whatever in this sort of field from whoever and wherever. My email inbox is always open. I think we better end it there. Thank you for the other two speakers for a engaging session. Thank you all for staying, and enjoy your lunch and safe travels back home.